listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Roman Empire by Tom Clute. Anoa'i receives a lot of scripts, but his WWE responsibilities have precluded him from taking many roles. When the time comes for him to fully pursue acting, Anoa'i plans on being selective. I almost want to model it after Tarantino, where we're not just doing anything and everything. I want to really plot out. I want this one. I want that one, Anoa'i says. As our flight makes its descent for Indianapolis, I make the half-serious suggestion that he might someday run for governor of Florida. You never know, he says with a smile. You just never know. He's joking, I think, but he's also right. Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jesse Ventura made it to the State House, and a WWE Hall of Famer currently occupies the White House. Plus, Anoa'i boasts the profile, a football player turned wrestler who loves lifting weights, of someone who could flourish in an electoral climate currently defined by expressions of raw masculinity. Anoa'i is a registered Democrat, but he considers himself a centrist. In the most recent election, however, he says the choice was very clear. One person was giving us information. One person was answering questions, so it wasn't that hard, he says. When I ask if that means that he backed Trump, Anoa'i pauses for a few seconds. I support our president. Trump is one of those guys where he's got a vast history and a huge background. He's been in entertainment. He's been in big business, politics, Anoa'i says. At this point, I'm supporting a bright future for our country, positive and competent leadership. For us to be what we're supposed to be a world leader, and carry that respect and do what a world power like us should be doing. Anoa'i doesn't back everything the president does. Like his penchant for nursing grievances against political rivals, it's like he needs that adversary, he says. He needs that opposition to bounce off of. He needs that competitive motivation or something. Trump's pugilistic approach, of course, is not unlike WWE's own template. It's why, in the Trump era, wrestling has been held up as a Rosetta Stone for understanding modern politics. To be honest, Anoa'i says, the world seems to be more like wrestling than any other form of entertainment. We land in Indianapolis on a cold, wet night, the sort of bleak, wintry conditions that compel you to stay inside and hunker down. And yet a smattering of WWE fans, young and old, are here, gathered outside the private airport. They hold replica WWE championship belts over their shoulders and hoist their index fingers in the air, a nod to Reigns' signature gesture. Anoa'i is hungry, so we pile into a pair of Escalades and zoom along the dampened streets to a steakhouse downtown. Four men in their 20s, each with replica title belts of their own, loiter outside and look curiously toward our SUVs. With the assistance of his personal security guard, Anoa'i and Heyman give the autograph hounds the slip and enter the restaurant through the back. You have to, at all times, consider this could be a Mark David Chapman type of thing, Heyman says, after we take our seats in a private room. This could be a real effing knucklehead. Anoa'i is a little spooked about the group at the airport, but he decides to accentuate the positive. Good problems, he declares. We call them blessed men problems. The time to worry is not when they're outside looking for you, Heyman replies. The time to worry is when they're not. That time isn't now. According to Levesque, Reigns is the biggest needle mover on the ticket sales side and a top merchandise seller, and he's got some famous fans. Roman has a profound presence in person at the WWE live events, and a seriousness and patience rarely seen in a performer, says Rick Rubin, the record producer and a pro wrestling diehard since childhood. It has been an historic run, Rubin adds, and I hope it continues for a long, long time. Being so highly in demand has left Anoa'i with an exhausting amount of corporate responsibilities. On the morning of the Royal Rumble, he and Heyman arrive at an Indianapolis barbershop to record promotional material for WWE 2K25, a new video game that features Reigns on the cover. Anoa'i is quickly briefed on the concept for each promo before he seamlessly shifts into character once the cameras start rolling. In one video, Anoa'i, as Reigns, and Heyman heckle a developer for the video game while he plays. "Can somebody tell me why we have a developer without a cheat code?" Heyman says in a moment of improvisation. After about 10 minutes, the videographers get the footage they need, and Reigns goes back to being Anoa'i. "Well done," he tells the developer. WWE stars spend their entire careers flipping that switch, constantly toggling between self and alter ego. For the uninitiated, it is not always easy to draw the distinction. At the barbershop, I overhear a woman involved with the video game ask a colleague how to address Anoa'i. "Best practice is to call them by their character name," he tells her, "especially at an event like this." We head to Lucas Oil Stadium, the home of the Indianapolis Colts, and the site of this year's Royal Rumble. As I stroll around hours before the gates open, it feels like I have stumbled upon a traveling circus company. There are muscular men and women in brightly colored attire and a small army of production personnel, all hurtling from the locker rooms to craft services. Inside the bowl of the stadium, rehearsal plays out in the ring. Cody Rhodes and Kevin Owens walk through a maneuver they will pull off in their ladder match. Meanwhile, Cena and Jey Uso pantomime the moves that will end the night's main event and crown Uso the winner of the Rumble. Outside the ring, Levesque talks to the YouTube personality Isho Speed, who will make a surprise appearance at the event, while WWE luminaries such as Ric Flair meander about the premises. Anoa'i calmly strolls up and down the entrance ramp, his head bowed meditatively. Backstage, closer to showtime, Heyman discusses a forthcoming storyline with the Scottish wrestler Drew McIntyre, real name Andrew McLean Galloway IV. Heyman grabs his phone and pulls up a clip from Peaky Blinders in which the character played by Tom Hardy profanely berates a crew of bootleggers. "Channel that," he tells McIntyre, who nods approvingly before walking out of the room. "Another satisfied customer," Heyman says. By 6 p.m. local time, there are around 70,000 customers inside the stadium, making it the largest gate ever for a single-night WWE event. The next 4.5 hours will be filled with pyrotechnics, acrobatics, and blood, all culminating with the eponymous main event. A spin on the traditional battle royale, the Royal Rumble is a glorious cluster F involving 30 wrestlers, with a new performer entering the ring every 90 seconds. This year's cavalcade builds toward the final entrant, the online influencer Logan Paul, who has a contract with WWE. The inclusion of Paul and Isho Speed shows how the company has managed to stay current, adapting its output to appeal to each new generation. It's also a window into the WWE business model, which is dependent on kids. There are plenty of adult fans here at the Royal Rumble, but the majority of them almost certainly started watching in their youth. It is comparatively more lighthearted than a UFC event, where the brutality is on full display and the vibe is similar to a Trump rally. Khan, citing Nielsen data, told me there is only about a 13% overlap between WWE and UFC viewers, which tracks with my own experience attending both. At the Royal Rumble, where there are at least two adult fans cosplaying as 80s icon Macho Man Randy Savage, the atmosphere is more Comic-Con than MAGA. When Roman Reigns' entrance music plays midway through, the crowd roars as thousands of index fingers are pointed to the sky. A short time later, after entering the ring, Reigns engages in a stare-down with several rivals, including Cena, prompting the thousands in attendance to chant, "This is awesome!" It is easy to understand why so many wrestlers struggle to walk away from the ring and continue to put their bodies through torture. The pop from the crowd is euphoric and addictive. A Noah E. could well become a box office star, or hell, even a politician, but he may never get the ovation that he has here at the Royal Rumble. As Roman Reigns stands in the ring, basking in the ovation, I keep thinking about what Joe Anoa'i told me the night before on the plane. "There's nothing like it. I do this, they do that," he said. "There's nothing like that control." Thank you. in good company as the Juilliard School kicks off its plan to go tuition-free. Vanity Fair gathered some august alumni to talk about memories and dreams by Chris Murphy, with photographs by Ruven Afanador. Opening photo, school days. Christine Baranski, Danielle Brooks, Jessica Chastain, Tony Siquillon, Kayla Mack, Damian Wetzel, John Baptiste, and Laura Lenny, photographed in February in the paint shop backstage at the Peter J. Sharp Theater at Juilliard. Sittings editor Nicole Chapoteau. For Christine Baranski, the most evocative space at the Juilliard School isn't a black box theater or a rehearsal room where she cut her teeth as an actor. "I get really emotional when I set foot in the elevator," she says with a sigh. She remembers its new car smell when she rode it in the early 1970s as part of the third class to ever study in the drama school. And she remembers, just as viscerally, the people she rode in it with. "I was in the elevator once with Leonard Bernstein, with Martha Graham, George Balanchine," she says. "I was in the elevator once with Maria Callas." If you know anything about Juilliard, it's probably that it is where some of our greatest artists learned to be great. The school, established in 1905 as the Institute of Musical Art in Manhattan's Greenwich Village, has long given students world-class training in their chosen discipline, dance, drama, or music. Last September, the drama department's MFA program went tuition-free, as the Yale School of Drama had a few years before. Now, and that is why we gathered some celebrated alumni for a portrait backstage at the school's Peter J. Sharp Theater, Juilliard has announced that it intends to go entirely tuition-free for every student. The great work has already begun. Starting this fall, 40% of Juilliard students will attend the institution at no cost. Reaching the school's ultimate goal will take serious fundraising, but other elite educational institutions are increasingly thinking along the same lines. Harvard College, for instance, announced that it will be tuition-free for families with incomes of under $200,000. Since he became Juilliard's president in 2018, Damian Wetzel, a former principal dancer with the New York City Ballet, has worked to make the school accessible to all students, not only increasing financial aid, but also designating several programs tuition-free already. Juilliard currently costs north of $50,000, not including room and board, and more than 95% of the students already receive some support from the school. The overall goal is to move steadily more tuition-free to that ultimate place and make sure that talent is the opportunity, not the ability to pay for it, Wetzel says. That opportunity is hard to come by. Juilliard's drama division typically accepts 18 students a year, 8 to 10 undergraduate students, and 8 to 10 graduate students, making it one of the most competitive and sought-after drama programs in the world. Even Baranski had a tough time getting in. "They put me on a waiting list in the spring," she says. It wasn't because she showed a lack of promise. "They thought that the space between my teeth might have been causing a sibilant S," she says. "Over the summer, I had dental work." After capping her teeth and taking speech therapy classes, Baranski re-auditioned for the speech teacher and the drama division's artistic director, Oscar winner John Houseman. "I did a paragraph that was filled with nothing but S words," she recalls. "It must have done the trick, because the moment the speech teacher signed off, Houseman accepted her on the spot." To this day, Baranski says, "it's one of the most moving moments of my life." Jessica Chastain calls Juilliard her home away from home. The Northern California native studied at the school in the early aughts, immersing herself in roles like Arkadina in The Seagull and honing the craft that would eventually win her an Oscar. When you're training, you have no idea what little seeds you're planting and growing inside of you, how it's going to develop into your career, Chastain says. The first from her family to attend college, she struggled to afford tuition, particularly on top of the hair-raising cost of living in New York City. I was so stressed out about money, she says. She worked part-time in the library and the student affairs office on her lunch breaks and took out loans. A lot of them to get by. I couldn't even afford to go to a restaurant, so it was all the cafeteria, she says. Ask how the food was, she winces. I mean, it's a cafeteria, she quips. After Chastain received the Robin Williams Scholarship, which covered the last 2 years of her four-year degree, she could breathe more freely. Having that cushion was like, okay, I can finish, she says. I can get my degree. I'll still be in debt, but I won't be consumed and overwhelmed by it. Danielle Brooks had to pay full tuition when she left South Carolina for Juilliard. I did not have the scholarship money, she says. My parents had to refinance our home for me to come here. Even that wasn't enough. Unfortunately, my godmother had passed away, and to my surprise, left me $20,000 in her will. That was what helped me to start my first semester at Juilliard. Brooks made it through the program, starring in productions like A Raisin in the Sun and Clybourne Park, while working multiple front desk jobs at the school, which she stuck with after graduation. I remember nights of crying right after I graduated, she says, not having the money and working all these odd jobs, trying to pay for college. Brooks is now a Tony and Oscar-nominated actor for the stage and screen versions of The Color Purple. My cheeks hurt from the joy of surviving this place, she says. John Batiste talks in terms of survival, too. He moved to Manhattan from New Orleans to study music at Juilliard in 2004. He was 17. Musically, he felt very prepared, but describes the transition to living in the city as very much a learning curve. He remembers surviving New York City, surviving the limitless options that are presented to you as an artist that's trying to discover who they are. Now a new member of Juilliard's Board of Trustees and the winner of 7 Grammys, he's come to believe that it's the institution's responsibility to provide a space where the students can wholly commit to their chosen passion with as little stress as possible. There's enough in trying to sing the perfect aria or to play in the jazz band, he says. There's so many summits that you have to climb before you can reach the level of greatness that everybody who comes here inevitably wants to reach. There are setbacks along the way, of course. I was unbelievably bad in a production here, says Laura Linney. I was distracted. I knew I was bad. It was brutally painful. So painful, she says, that she decided to walk away from the school altogether. Then an acting teacher took her aside and taught her the most important lesson she'd ever learn at Juilliard. He said, this is where you're supposed to fail. You'll never learn until you learn how to fail. Now, the 4-time Emmy winner is a vice chair of Juilliard's board. I've never left again. How do the alums feel about future students getting a free ride? Give me my money back, Brooks deadpans. Y'all owe me. Chastain says that removing the barrier of paying tuition is a great equalizer for aspiring artists. If the children of wealthy families have a built-in advantage, she says, then the whole industry is populated with privilege. In her opinion, that doesn't always make for the most vital art. Those aren't the stories that I necessarily think we should focus on and tell. Money will always be a factor in the life of an artist. It's a famously precarious profession, after all. But with a tuition-free arts education, students can focus on collaboration rather than starvation. At the shoot, Brooks and her old friend Batiste talked about working together when they studied drama and music here. We were thinking about MLK Day and the performances we used to put on, she says. We were all just creating together. For this portrait, The veterans were joined by Kayla Mack, a current Juilliard student and dancer with American Ballet Theater's studio company, and Tony Siki-Yun, an award-winning classical pianist and recent Juilliard grad. Batiste, who stationed next to a grand piano, couldn't help but improvise with whatever song came next on the playlist. Soon enough, Brooks was riffing along with Batiste in perfect harmony, and Baranski was cooing melodious oohs and ahs. By the end of the shoot, Batiste and Yun had spontaneously begun playing the four-hand arrangement of Beethoven's Virtuosi Appassionata Sonata. "We had an impromptu jam on that," Batiste says later. He's already charting Yun's path forward. "He's going to pick up the baton," Batiste says. "He doesn't just want to star in the world, he also wants to build it." Open Road. F1 Academy, the all-women racing league launched in 2023, is aiming its drivers at the sport's highest echelon, by Dan Adler. Opening photograph by Mark Seliger, styled by Nicole Chapoteau. In the photo, Leah Block, Courtney Crone, and Chloe Chambers, photographed at the Hard Rock Stadium in Miami. Courtney Crone has been on wheels since she was just a few years old. Her father had been a competitive driver, but success in motorsports is highly correlated with money. When his funds ran low, he started maintaining vintage cars for a living. Eventually, he passed the bug to his only child, a daughter, which allowed him to poke at the traditional expectations for such passion's heirs. "He likes to joke," Crone recalls, "and say I was this little boy and he put me on a motorcycle and it all took off from there." Now 24, Crone belongs to a class of young women drivers at the elite tier of a steep hierarchy. Beginning this year, she will compete in F1 Academy, a female-only racing series founded by Formula One in 2023, with an eye toward preparing its drivers to aim higher still, ideally all the way up to F1 itself, long an all-male competition. Racing at these levels is intensely niche and intrinsically neurotic. Crone fits a recognizable pattern, bred nearly from birth and by her own account, engaged in a lifelong mental tactical battle against herself. When we spoke, she was at the Thermal Club near Palm Springs, California, a country club with a racetrack where she coaches. "Every driver's individual in what makes them tick," she says, "including, in some instances, just pure chaos. Sometimes angry behind the wheel." That struggle makes for great reality TV, as it turns out. The Netflix docuseries Formula One, Drive to Survive, which premiered in 2019, put a real housewives sheen on the sport's psychological aspects, ratcheting up its anxieties and rivalries. The show made F1 and all its European trappings a genuine pop culture phenomenon in America, with new races in Las Vegas and Miami, and created a fresh global fan base, primed to understand athletes as celebrities above all else. F1 Academy Managing Director Susie Wolf, a former pro driver and a Drive to Survive star in her own right, she is married to Mercedes' billionaire team principal Toto Wolf, saw an opportunity in the surge. Like many leading players in the sport, she lives in Monaco, but was in her London office when she reflected on her own path. "I didn't have any outstanding female role models," she says. "Her parents encouraged her to achieve anything that my brother could achieve," she continues. "But I do think in this day and age, I would have benefited hugely from having a role model that had done what I would want to achieve." This year, as it gears up for its third go-round, F1 Academy will attempt to tap into the entertainment space that Drive to Survive carved out. Reese Witherspoon's production company, Hello Sunshine, trailed the competitors during the second season, and a docuseries will premiere on Netflix later this year. Wolf emphasizes that she wouldn't have wanted to be involved in the Academy if she felt that it was a diversity box-ticking exercise. While F1 is the rare sport in which gender does not amount to a physical edge, it is rooted in long-running traditions and entrenched pipelines, especially at its upper rungs. But the profile of what makes for a successful F1 driver has begun to shift, or at least the Netflix-viewing public has begun to acquire a different view of it. "One of the things that every driver goes through," Chloe Chambers tells me, "is having the off-track stuff be more work than the on-track." Chambers, 20, was born in China and raised in New York's Hudson Valley, where her British-born adoptive father was an F1 enthusiast. When she was still in grade school, they found a track near their house, and she got started. Ambitious as she was, the public-facing side of the job didn't come naturally. "I definitely was way more on the quiet, shy side than I am now," Chambers says, As I've grown up, I've gained that confidence to go out and speak to people and be able to turn on my social mode. Last season, she went with Amna and Hamda Al-Kubaisi, Emirati-born F1 Academy drivers and sisters, to their grandmother's house, where she spent time with birds, deer, turtles, dogs, and goats. The Witherspoon-backed cameras were rolling. Before, I'd say, oh yeah, I'm going to go race at whatever F1 race, Chambers says, remembering interactions with classmates, and they'd be like, oh, that's cool, but we don't get it. But now I post on social media, she goes on, and I get a bunch of messages from people that I went to high school with. Next photo, speed thrills. Susie Wolf waves the checkered flag at the Jeddah Corniche Circuit in Saudi Arabia and Block at the Yas Marina Circuit in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. Block on the track during F1 Academy testing in Qatar. It's such a big game playing chicken back and forth with yourself in the car, Block says. Since its premiere, Drive to Survive has spawned a crowd of imitators. The show did not invent the behind-the-scenes confessional style of sports documentary, but its runaway success in popularizing F1 has hardened the format into a distinctly modern genre, particularly in more esoteric competitive corners. There are now similarly conceived shows about professional surfing, rugby, golf, NASCAR, and tennis. Next photo, Rev Up. Krohn racing at Lusail International Circuit in Qatar. Krohn at a practice at Miami International Autodrome. Every driver's individual in what makes them tick, Krohn says. And Chambers prepares to get behind the wheel. Wolf's favorite, she tells me, is Tour de France, Unchained, another Netflix production that follows professional cyclists. That's one of the challenges, she says. There's so much content out there. There's so much different sports. How do we break through and actually create our own fan base that people are tuning in to watch F1 Academy, that they're educated as to what we are and why we exist? The sport's up-and-coming athletes who grew up on social media are increasingly aware that their results on the track will only account for a portion of their overall performance. In May 2020, the late rally driver Ken Block had his 13-year-old daughter Leah riding shotgun. The goal was to teach her to do donuts. He explained the technique and demonstrated. When Leah got behind the wheel, the camera caught bits of apprehension, but mostly enthusiasm. That's it, Ken said near the end of his YouTube video about the exercise. She struggled a bit, but she did it, and I'm really stoked. My dad, most of his career was built around social media, Leah Block tells me from her home in Park City, Utah. Ken, who also co-founded DC Shoes, found his most devout audience on YouTube. It's the thing to get sponsorship and get funding, because motorsport, especially the F1 world, is very expensive, Leah says. That's the reason why it's so elite, and not everybody can do it. She has a composed and easy manner, a counterpoint to her self-identification as an adrenaline junkie. Block, who turned 18 in October and was competing in rally races by 15, was in some sense anointed. After her father's death in a 2023 snowmobile accident, his friend and X-Game star Travis Pastrana described her as a natural heir. The legacy didn't seem to weigh on her. You have to have some sort of fearlessness with some things, she says, almost offhandedly, but you also have to be dedicated. It has to be something that you want so bad that you will do anything to get it. In this new era of F1, of most sports with commercial designs, it is a necessary attribute, but perhaps not a sufficient one. The competition is the other drivers, but it is also the other Netflix series and online personalities. Still, Block thinks her prospects and those of the young women around her will ultimately hinge on a more timeless matter. It's such a big game playing chicken back and forth with yourself in the car, she says. You're having to push those limits that usually aren't pushed. Now, here's the Proust questionnaire with an illustration by Ryan McAmis. Hugh Grant, the star of Heretic on his Dearest Loves, Dishonesty, His Barbecue, and Greatest Nemesis, Scissors, Colin Firth. Which historical figure do you most identify with? Scott of the Antarctic, an angry, disappointed little man. "What is your favorite occupation? I have recently fallen in love with barbecuing. I love to undercook chicken and give my family worms. What is the trait you most deplore in yourself? I am unable to use scissors. What is the trait you most deplore in others? Telling me the menu is only accessible through the QR code. What is your greatest extravagance? Barbecue equipment, especially heat-resistant gloves. I am wearing some as I type. What do you consider the most overrated virtue? Honesty. I'm sometimes asked by people who've just seen one of my films, do you mind if I'm honest? I do. On what occasion do you lie? When asked whether everything is all right with my meal. What is your idea of perfect happiness? Drinking a pint of London Pride while munching Twiglets and reading about Colin Firth having a critical and box office catastrophe. What is your greatest fear? The cat bowls, with the old cat food dried on like cement. What do you dislike most about your appearance? My cloud of powder gray hair. I look like Liberace, or a cigarette. Which living person do you most despise? Anyone in private equity, or tech, or London traffic planning, or who uses a leaf blower? Which words or phrases do you most overuse? Watch out, dog shit. And shall we open another bottle? What or who was the greatest love of your life? Scandawife, sociopathic children, cats. What is your current state of mind? Deranged. Where would you like to live? In Maria's Abbey, in the Sound of Music, the Peace, the Mother Superior. What is your most marked characteristic? Thinly veiled fury. What do you most value in your friends? Failure, unhappiness. What are your favorite names? Our local dentist growing up was Mr. Fang, lovely man, though he liked to be naked under his smock. What is it that you most dislike? Leaf blowers, scented candles, drafts, backpacks, water bottles, stretch fabrics. How would you like to die? My wife has kindly agreed to sneak up behind me and shoot me in the back of the head. And that was the Proust questionnaire with Hugh Grant. star-studded beauty, L'Oreal Paris touches up our favorite celebrities at Vanity Fair's Oscars party. In the photos, Elle Fanning gets her glow from Plump Ambition lip oil, and Kendall Jenner achieves a last-minute lift with Panorama mascara. Not to brag, but Vanity Fair's annual post-Oscars bash is always the hottest ticket of the night. It is also, incidentally, one of the most talked-about red carpets of the entire year, which means that everyone from A-listers to up-and-comers definitely feels the pressure to look their absolute best. No small feat, considering that the festivities don't kick off until after Best Picture, and most stars perform a quick outfit change before hitting the event. Luckily, L'Oreal Paris's touch-up bar was on hand to make the transition from the awards show to the after-party all the chicer. Perched on the edge of the Vanity Fair Oscar party's red carpet with a selection of L'Oreal Paris brand favorites, the first-ever touch-up bar ensured no star walked the step and repeat with a hair out of place or a lip left unglossed. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selections by Mark Hoffman.